I hope you can all hear me, and I hope you can all understand my English. The last time I was in Denmark, I was in Copenhagen, and everybody there spoke better English than me. So, you know, I'm assuming that you can all understand me, and I hope my accent isn't too bad for you. I'm sat in my office here in my own home, actually, because I'm on annual leave at the moment, on holiday. But it's nice to be with you all, even if I'm only here in a kind of a virtual capacity. And my presentation for you this afternoon is, as it says on the screen here, that's me underneath. On Twitter, I'm Tim Buckteeth, and I'm at Plymouth University, which is probably one of the largest universities in the United Kingdom. And I'll start with a quote for you, actually, which I hope will resonate with some of you, because you're all teacher educators just like me, and I'll let you read that for yourself. And for me, one of the biggest challenges for teachers is that we equalize the power, that we stop thinking of ourselves as the font of all knowledge and wisdom, and students as empty vessels to be filled, and we start thinking about a collaborative, reciprocal arrangement for teaching and learning, where we both become each at the same time, which for me is probably the best way forward. But that's a big challenge for us all to think about. So I'll let you think about that as we move through the rest of this presentation. Here's what I hope to talk about today. There are several areas which I'll try to emphasize for you, but all of these areas here I think are challenges for teachers today and for learners also. So perhaps as we go through these, maybe if there's any questions at the end, you store them up and we have a discussion at the end of this presentation. First question for you is this: how open are you? Do you, when you go into lecture or to teach, do you shut the door behind you? So it's just you and your teachers, trainees, or your students. Do you open the door and let other people come in and take part? Do you open your classroom up in terms of technology? Do you live stream it, or do you lecture capture? These are all important questions, I think, for 21st century education. How open are we? And what would happen if you gave your content away for free? What would happen if you gave your courses away for free? This is something that's happening a lot in the UK and in Canada and in America and all over the world, in fact. Now you're seeing massively online open courses where students are just openly able to access content and to tuition without paying for it. What they pay for, in fact, is the accreditation at the end if they want to go that far. But generally speaking, we need to start thinking about openness more. You'll probably notice that in the bottom corner of my slides you've got a CC license, which stands for Creative Commons. Now that means that all of the slides that I make available, including this one here, the pictures that I take, that's taken of my library at the university, that's on the wall, a man walking through the wall with reading a book, all of these pictures are actually openly licensed so that you can copy them free of charge. So I give away all my content for free. And I think that's an important issue for us to look at as a challenge for education in the future. And you can ask the question, do these children deserve a good education? To which your answer is undoubtedly yes, of course they do. All children deserve a good education. What about these children? Do they deserve a good education? Of course they do. And yet they don't actually receive a good education, because these children, I took this picture in the Gambia in West Africa about a year and a half ago when I was there with my students, and these children in very, very hot temperatures are walking backwards and forwards every day to fetch firewood and to fetch water for cooking and washing and so on, because they have a very poor infrastructure. And because they have to do this, they have no time to go to school. So these children are uneducated children. And this is happening all over the world. And we have to ask ourselves the question, how do we get these children into school? Well, being more open is one way of doing it. 500 million children outside of education. And according to Stephen Happel, who's a British professor you may have heard of, he says that all it would take to get them in would be $5 billion. Now, that sounds a lot of money to an individual, but for corporations and for governments, it's not a lot of money at all. And we have to ask ourselves, you know, why do we commoditize knowledge? Why do we charge for knowledge when, in fact, all over the world there are people suffering and wanting it? Now, this is a really interesting picture. obviously it's permanent. And Derek Bock said, if you think education is expensive, then try ignorance. That's a permanent feature there. That cannot be wiped out like on a chalkboard or a whiteboard. It's there permanently, and it's a big mistake. And yet it's pointing the way to education. And I think that's a classic image which illustrates this point that education may be expensive, but ignorance is going to be even worse. So there is money involved in this, and we have to pay for it. But at the same time, we can equalize this by giving away a lot of our content for free. And we have the tools to be able to do that now. Another big problem is can we predict the future? Teachers are always trying to anticipate what's coming next. You know, what changes will there be? What new technologies will there be? How will schools look in the future? And a U.S. mayor, when he saw the new telephone that Alexander Graham Bell had invented, he said, one day every town in America will have one of these. And he was right. Every town in America has a telephone. If you've been to America, you will know that there's a telephone in every town in America. What the mayor could not see in his narrow vision of the future was that every person would have one in their pocket as well. And this is one of the major advances in the 21st century, in the 20th century, was the advent of the first of the telephone and then the mobile phone. And I think if we try and predict the future, like this guy is trying to do here, soothsayer or fortune teller, then we sometimes come unstuck, and we have to be careful about people who try and predict the future for us, because often they have a vested interest. Take this expression here about the telephone from the man who was in charge of the British Post Office in 1878. He said, the Americans have need of the telephone, but we do not. We have plenty of messenger boys. And that was a very blinkered, a very narrow view also of the future. And we must be very careful when we listen to people trying to predict the future to us. One person who can, I think, have a lot to say about the future is Ray Kurzweil, who is a futurologist who actually said something very profound. He said, change is not linear, change is now exponential. And I'm going to show you some of the issues that surround that in a moment. Another big challenge for teachers is to manage change. Before we do that, back in 1989, the future was thought to be multimedia, and most people predicted that, and of course that's what happened, because we can actually look at trends, and without really being specific in what we predict, we can actually talk about what the trends will indicate. So back in 1999, when I was in Berlin at a conference, I was on a panel, and in front of about 250 people, they asked me what the future would be of learning, and I said, I think it's going to be the internet. I think it's going to be the web. And at the time, I kind of took the risk, but I knew from looking at the trends what I thought would be happening. Then a few years ago in London, I was asked the same question again back in 2009, and I stuck my neck out there again and made another prediction and said, I think the future is going to be smart mobile. And I think that that is coming true, so I was lucky there that that prediction was correct. So we can predict the future in some ways. And I'll show you that here's the first mobile phone. It's a kind of, you have to have two of them, so it's a his and hers, you know, mobile phone. And that's just my little joke. The first mobile phone, in fact, was this one here, designed by this man, Malcolm Cooper, back in the UK in the 80s. And they called it the brick because it was such a massive phone, because it had such a huge battery in it. And the battery probably lasted about 30 minutes maximum. Now, with battery technologies and with miniaturization of technology, things are coming down in size and also in cost. And now, of course, we can carry them in our pockets. And in fact, maybe each one of you has at least one cell phone or mobile phone on you at the moment. And one thing that is happening is that if you look at what's happening, multimedia brought the world into the classroom, but smart mobile technologies will take the classroom back out into the world again. And I think that's an important challenge for us as teachers to think about. One of the things that's happening is that students are bringing their own mobile devices into the classroom now. And here's something that you'll see almost everywhere in major cities around the world. Here are five generations of mobile device. On the left-hand side, you'll see the laptop. It's an Apple laptop there. Then you see next to it maybe people using the handheld technology that allows them to scan things or whatever. Maybe it's an iPod Touch, maybe it's a games machine. Next to that, you'll see the Kindle reader, which is designed and sold by Amazon. Then next to that, again, you'll probably see a mobile phone. And then you've got the book, which was the first mobile device, revolutionary device, which allowed us to go on the move with our learning. And this is what I see happening now more and more, is the idea that we're on the move, we're mobile, we're ambient, and we can take our learning with us anywhere. That's a big challenge for teachers for the future, for us to think about how we're going to manage that. And we are becoming distributed beings, said Mark Curtis. And that's just becoming much more overt as we see all these new technologies being released and then used by people in public. So the big challenge for us, really, I suppose, is to think of the web and mobile technologies together, combined as an important set of tools. They do allow us to create content. They do allow us to meet together. They're not just a place for looking things up, says Alec Kuros. So I'm going to come back to that point later on in this presentation. But can you imagine what would happen if you stopped the internet for 60 seconds, for 1 minute only? What would happen? These are the things that you would miss. You'd miss nearly 200,000 emails being sent, nearly 700,000 search inquiries on Google alone, nearly 700,000 Facebook status updates as well. But interestingly, if you look on the right-hand side there, you'll see that only one new paper-based article is being published every minute somewhere in the world. That's still a lot, but it's a lot less than what you're seeing happening with the user-generated content that's being created through these mobile technologies and through social media. And the reason for all this content being generated is this. Look at these social media use statistics. These are about, I suppose, 6 months out of date now. They relate to about the beginning of the year, but look at the membership of these social spaces. Twitter, LinkedIn, Google+, YouTube, 60 hours of video being uploaded every minute onto YouTube. Most of it's rubbish. You know, there's a lot of dross out there, but some of it is also very useful for teachers if they think about how to use it. And a couple more here. 6 billion images on Flickr. That is dwarfed by Facebook, which has at least three times that amount of content on it in terms of images now, and growing all the time because of the 850 million users. And 14 million articles in various languages on Wikipedia. Again, we're going to return to Wikipedia in a minute, because I think that's a big challenge for teachers as well. So look at the ownership of mobile phones. Where's Denmark? It's number 12 there. That's pretty good, 83%. Of ownership of mobile phones. You notice at the top you've got Taiwan and Luxembourg with over 100% of ownership. That's because a lot of people have more than one device. So I know some people who have three or four different mobile phones because they use them for different purposes, social work and so on. So this is not the amount of ownership in terms of population. This is the amount of ownership in terms of devices. So that's how many accounts there are currently. So 5.9 billion mobile accounts in the world, that could, if everybody owned one each, that could equate to nearly 90% of the population of the world. It doesn't, but it could do. So that's quite a phenomenal growth. And as teachers, we have to be aware of the potential and the kind of the possibilities there of that. And user-generated content is a challenge in itself, because how do we measure the accuracy of it? How do we validate whether it's good content or not? How do we discuss how relevant it is to our society? Maybe it's crazy people out there writing stuff which they can't prove. So we have to be careful with user-generated content of all types. But having said that, it's becoming quite an important thing now for academics in terms of things like blogs and wikis, podcasts, videos and so on, and social media content, to actually present themselves now, present their research to the world in a very open and valid way. So there is a kind of a balancing act we need to look at there. Mobile game-based learning is on the rise. Notice here that now 53% of mobile gamers are female, gaming through handheld devices. I think that this is an important trend for us to think about and to consider. I took this picture in Prague Airport in the Czech Republic back in May, and it's a little lad, a little boy here, playing for free on an Xbox 360 Kinect. And you're going to see this increasingly being allowed to be open in public places. This was in an airport concourse. It could be anywhere. It could be in a shopping mall. It could be in, in outside a football stadium. It could be anywhere. And what he's doing is playing games there. And this is a huge trend. And we have to, as teachers, face the challenge of games-based learning. Graham Byrne Martin actually said something very profound recently. At the beginning of the year, when we play games, we rapidly solve abstract problems in real time whilst being continually assessed and often working in teams collaboratively. Aren't those exactly the attributes we need for young people today to go into a world of work with? Think about it. How do we harness the power of these games-based technologies in the classroom and into formalized education? Here's another image I took at Prague Airport. This is, as you can see, it's a QR tag, a quick response tag. And these, again, are going to be, I think, become much more important for us. Can you imagine these around schools or universities or colleges? You know, they're already appearing. Devices which allow you to take your mobile phone up to it and actually capture the information which takes you to a website somewhere without having to tap it all in letter by letter. Here's a picture that I often show to illustrate the point that we are connected. I don't know if you know where this is or can see what is happening here, but if you look at it closely, you'll see that there's Barack Obama, and he's talking to the people of Berlin. This was before he was elected as president, the first black president of the United States of America. This is history being made here, and can you see what the people in the background are all doing? What they're doing, in effect, is they're holding up devices in their hands. They're capturing the moment. They're taking pictures. There's even a guy there holding up a laptop, if you look above the flag there, above the scarf in the middle, holding up a laptop and live streaming. And these people were actually connecting personally, connecting with people that they cared about and saying, look, I'm here. I want to share this moment with you. So we are, in effect, living in a very connected society now. And if we ignore this, then I think we are very stupid. We have to understand that young people are now very connected, and we must tap into the potential and harness the power of this in some way. That's a big challenge for teachers. How can we do that? Another thing that we need to think about is the personalization of learning. That's a big challenge for us. How can we take these devices and, you know, mobile learning and social media and all the other connections that young people are being able to make now, and how can we harness the power of those into personalizing and individualizing learning? See, personalized learning is about individual differences being acknowledged and respected. Now, I'll give you an example of how this can be done in a social context. Can you imagine in the 1950s, you've got this family sat here watching the television, and there's probably one or two channels on, and it's black and white, and after about 10 o'clock, the little white light comes on, and it blinks out, and the national anthem comes on, and then it goes black, and everything finishes for the day. Now, of course, we have many, many more channels, but you can imagine, we, our family here, becomes everybody gathered around like a little tribe around a totem pole, and they have the same experience in the same social context. How can we make that personalized? Well, the answer is to go to We Are Family. This is the Nintendo Wii. These are the same family, if you like, around the same television set. But no, they all have a difference. They all have an individual device in their hands, a personalized device. Each of them can now change the context of what they're seeing in front of them. Within the social context, they can have personalized learning experiences. And that, I think, is the clue to how we're going to personalize learning in the future. It's personal devices. Bring your own device. Big challenge for schools, big challenge for colleges and universities. Young people will bring their devices into the classroom with them, and they will use them, whether we tell them to or not. Teachers object to this. Lots of schools ban mobile phones being used in the classroom, but they're still used, and they will still use them for various ways and means. We also have to consider whether the future is going to be non-touch. Will our children, our grandchildren, sit on our knees in a few years' time and say to us, Granddad or Grandma, did you really have to touch a computer to make it work? Well, we'll see. There are various other devices coming in now, other tools and other technologies, such as augmented reality. Two versions of this, the phone application and the wearable technology. There's the wearable one. There's one of them. That's MIT's Sixth Sense wearable computer, which consists of a camera, a projector, a mirror, and a telephone, which connects to the internet in your pocket. And with that, you can project onto any surface. Have a look at that on the YouTube video or the TED Talk video. If you need to have a look at and see how that works, it's quite a fabulous way of creating a web that meets the world, if you like, where all of these things are possible, where you can manipulate images with your fingers without touching anything. And it really does kind of remind me of Tom Cruise in Minority Report, that Hollywood blockbuster with the natural user interfaces, non-touch, gestural interaction, natural gestures. This, for me, is a transparent type of technology. You can see through it. You don't have to think too much about how to work the technology. What you're really doing is thinking about the learning. And that's what's been so wrong with all of our technology in the past for education. Children and young people and students have to think too much about how to navigate around and how to, you know, make the machine work. And this is why things like the institutional VLE have been such a problem. It's because learning is buried. Learning is opaque. These systems will make it much more transparent because they'll be easier to use. And they will allow us, with that natural gesturing, to connect to our own personal learning networks, which are going to be so important to us in the future. There's a huge challenge for teaching, a huge challenge for education. How do we harness the power of that? There are social issues as well with the use of mobile phones and social media. I'll go through some of them with you. One of them is that there is a kind of a public performance happening here. We have to manage our own impression. And if we manage it wrongly by posting up images that are not good or we're saying things in public which on Twitter which can be misconstrued, then if as professionals we put ourselves in a very, very difficult and dangerous position. So there's also the idea of blogging on the move, which can open us up to all sorts of possibilities. It can be a good thing or a bad thing. How do we measure the, how do we protect ourselves from the problems of this? There is the idea that emotional ties and social ties may be weak. They tend to isolate people as well sometimes. So these issues need to be considered and researched more before we can safely say that we understand them. And then there's the question of whether language is being dumbed down. You know, is language being destroyed as a result of texting and as a result of, you know, emailing and as a result of things like social media and Facebook? Have you noticed that young people today are kind of concatenating their language down? They're knocking it down so that it sounds like it's spelt and so on. Well, some teachers have a real issue with this, but I just want to show you something here while I take a cup of tea. I'm an Englishman. I'm allowed a cup of tea. Can you recognize that? If anyone recognizes it, go to the top of the class, because it's actually the Lord's Prayer in 160 characters, which was a competition to see if anybody could take 422 characters and knock it down to 160 and keep the meaning of it intact. So if you look at it, it's actually very creative. It's a creative form of expression. It's not good English. And maybe in Denmark you have a similar issue with this, but it's creative nonetheless. And David Crystal, who is probably one of the most the foremost experts in English language in the world, said this. He said the ethos of 50 years ago was that there was one kind of English that was right and everything else was wrong. There's a new ethos now, and that has come about largely because of the introduction of these type of technologies. Peter Yeomans, who's a colleague of mine in Plymouth, said something very interesting recently. He said, mobile phones, they're actually forcing children to become more literate, not less literate, because they're now having to learn to communicate in a variety of different modes. So they have to learn to write and to read, and they have to learn how to speak and to listen. Then they have to learn how to text. Then they have to learn how to Facebook. Then they have to learn how to, and so on, and on it goes. And there are lots of different modes of expression now available, which we never had when we were in school. So they're having to participate in various cultures now, not just one. And it's quite a rapidly moving and shifting area. managing identity. As I said before, if you post up a picture of yourself falling out of a pub or a bar, absolutely stone drunk, and you're a student, it's not such a big deal. But then in 3 years' time, when you come to try and get a job and the head teacher of the school, the principal of the school, Googles you and finds your Facebook page and sees this picture of you, are they going to be impressed? Are they even going to give you an interview? Is this student going to be able to look after the children in my school, effectively, if they fall out of pubs drunk? So we have to think about managing our identity and thinking about how we protect our identity online. Here's a quote from Socrates. I'm sorry about this. I've got the wrong Socrates here. This was my son. We were watching the Olympics, and he decided to put up a picture of Socrates for me. That's the wrong Socrates. That's the footballer Socrates from Brazil. I'll find the right image in a moment. Actually, no, I've got this right now. That was actually said by Plato, not Socrates. So I'll need to find a picture of Plato. Here we go. Let's see if I can find a picture of Plato here. Sorry again. That is Socrates. That is the philosopher Socrates, the Greek philosopher. That's a picture of Plato. No, I've got it right. Okay, there we are. Now, for me, that is what we would call Darwinianism. It's the survival of the fittest content. It's an evolution, if you like, of content till it becomes optimum, till it becomes the best it is. And you'll see this happening on lots of social media sites now. Iteration, reiteration, polishing, editing, deleting, revising. It all comes out in pages like Wikipedia. And if you look at the bottom of Wikipedia now, you'll see that they're trying to tighten up on the accuracy and the objectivity and the completeness and the well, you know, how well written these articles are, by asking people to rate the page and then to tell you whether they are highly knowledgeable on that subject or not. So I think Wikipedia is becoming much more accurate as a source of knowledge now than it used to be. So therefore, a lot of the criticism that was aimed at it is now maybe dissipating somewhat. We need to think about technologies not as neutral anymore. They are now loaded with nuance and with meaning, and technologies can no longer be said to be neutral, I think. And I'll tell you why. They take over our lives. I think Nielsen recently, which is a media watchdog in the United States, said that the average American citizen now consumes up to 12 hours of media content a day. That includes television, audio, visual, text, internet, and so on. And they're doing it in multiple tasking now. So they're watching the television while they're texting, while they're on their laptop. And if you combine all that together, we're actually exposing ourselves to around about 10 to 12 to 14 hours of media content each day. And that can be overwhelming. It's a huge problem for most teachers and for most professionals. So we have all these questions to ask. How do we find stuff? How do we know it's accurate? How do we share it? And amongst all that stuff that keeps bombarding us every day, how do we find the good stuff? And how do we ignore all the bad stuff? How do we organize it and categorize it? That's what we feel like often. We feel overloaded. And I would like to say to you that content is no longer king. Bill Gates was right back about 20 years ago, but now content is no longer king. It's a tyrant. It's something that rules our lives. I would say to you now that context is now king. The context, the what it's couched within, where it's located, that content is then useful because of the context of it. That's what's king now, I think. And I'll give you another example of that. In hunting culture, says Henry Jenkins, kids play with bows and arrows. In an information society, they play with information. And this is the big issue for teachers. I'm watching the time here, but we're okay. Big issue for teachers is this. How do we organize and filter content so that it's the right content from the internet and from various media for our students to consume? And should we be doing that? I show my young people in my classroom, my 18-year-olds, I show them this image. And if they're not very familiar with American history, they won't know what this is. I'm sure you know what it is. It's the assassination of Lee Harvey Oswald, who had allegedly shot President Kennedy. And on the right is Jack Ruby pointing a gun, and he's shooting Lee Harvey Oswald dead. If instead we manipulated that image and we showed this, and I said to my young people, This is a band from the 60s. Lee Harvey and the Wailers. You know, I could slip in a subliminal political message here that Lee Harvey did not play alone. So you can see how this actually works, can't you? You can see how you swap the two around. You can manipulate the truth. You can change the truth. And whatever you then present becomes acceptable to the people who are receiving it, unless, of course, they are thinking critically. If they think critically, they'll see through the ruse and they will understand that there is a scam going on here. Another example of this is viral videos that go viral. Videos that actually, because of various things like their popularity or the humor behind them or usefulness in some ways, they actually become, you know, kind of the best selling, if you like, on the internet. So top left is Star Wars Kid, 25 million views to date on just one version of that. There are lots of versions of it. Next there is the Numa Numa song with 46 million views. Then underneath, 51 million views for the State Penitentiary Michael Jackson Thriller reenactment. And finally, Charlie Bit My Finger, which has currently 447 million views. It's a huge audience out there for this content. How are we going to harness the power of that? How are we going to reach out with education and with learning to people who would otherwise not come to school? This is what new learners are, according to John Waters' research, all of those things. But most importantly, they like to collaborate, get feedback from their peers, and they become the nodes of their own production. They like to produce content themselves. So you're going to see a lot of that, but they need a lot more than that. Here's the biggest challenge of all, I think, for teachers. And that is, how do we promote literacies rather than just skills? I talk about literacies because they allow students to embed themselves within a culture. Skills are how to do something. Literacies are the understanding of why you do something. So this is a left-hand drive car like you have in Denmark, perhaps. If you came to drive in the UK, you'd be driving on the left-hand side of the road with a right-hand drive car. And you'd have to understand the road signs. You'd have to understand the unwritten rules that happen when you learn to drive in the UK and so on. So it becomes a literacy that you have to acquire, not just a skill. The skills are how to do it. The literacy is much more than that. And this is what we need to see happening with young people and with teachers in the use of social media and mobile telephony these days. So here's not an exhaustive list, but this is some of the things that I think we need to consider. Transliteracy, if you don't know what it means, is the ability to present yourselves equally well across multiple platforms. That all of these here, I think, are becoming really important literacies for the 21st century. And Doug Belshaw actually did his PhD in this recently. He came up with 8 different elements of digital literacy, which I think are quite useful to think about here. And almost anything you do online can be categorized into at least one of those, if not more. And then we've got the idea of management of content. What about how do we organize and manage that content? That's a big challenge for teachers today. I show my students this sometimes, and I say, what's wrong with it? And they go, is it 70%? And I say, no. And they go, I know what it is. That's not Thomas Edison. And I say, yes, it is. And of course, then they get it. Then they understand the problem behind that piece of imagery. They need digital wisdom. We all need digital wisdom. We all need the wisdom to be able to use the technology effectively, but not get taken in by it. And not get taken in by all the stuff that's happening out there, which is bad or off center. So I'll move on and I'll let you think about that. Here's something that happens on my blog regularly. If you have a blog, you'll know that you can actually receive comments from people. And if you moderate them, which I do, here's the reason why, then you'll know that you can screen and filter them before you put up the comments. Now, I let every comment through except these type of comments. This is an anonymous comment from somebody who is trying to post up onto my blog some links. You can probably just see them there. If you look at nice posting, and then underneath it, next to it, there's a little hyperlink there. And there's another one after sharing as well. Those are hidden hyperlinks. and they're trying to get those past my system so that it goes onto my site, so that then anybody who clicks onto those links, it may take them to a bad site where they get a virus, or where they can be attacked by hackers, or something else. So when it's hacking like that, or malware, or when it's trolling, which is bad comments, then I tend to moderate those out, and those do not appear on my website. I want to protect my readers. So this is another area of digital wisdom we have to start thinking about now, the idea about managing our content and managing who interacts with us as well. Digital literacy isn't a condition. It's a condition. It's not a threshold. It's a state of mind. It's about thinking constantly about, is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing to do? It's about understanding more deeply what we're doing with the tools around us. That's a big challenge for teachers. Marshall McLuhan, you know, in answer to the is technology neutral question, he said, if we shape our tools, then thereafter our tools shape us, which is true. They do tend to direct our behavior in some ways if we let them. So we have to be careful about that too, about technology taking us over. Here's something that's really important for us to consider as teachers. The digital footprint of children is now from birth, and in some cases before that, pregnant mothers. They like to show their scans now, the ultrasound scans, onto Facebook. Here's my baby. It's going to be born in 3 months' time. Here's the picture of it. 81% of children under the age of 2 have some kind of digital footprint in parts of Europe and North America now. I think this is a staggering statistic, and we need to take consideration of this, because these children will soon be growing up and coming into our schools and colleges and universities, and they will be expecting to have total access to these technologies. What they do is they tend to share content, but they consume it, remix it, and produce it as well. It's not just sharing, it's actually being involved in producing it. If you want a child to be creative, they say give him a camera, let him take pictures. And you see it happening so often. How do we assess all this? Big challenge for teachers. How are we going to assess all of this new content that children are creating? Is it going to become a part of their assessment? If so, well, we will need new assessment methods to be able to cope with the new formats. We need to think about that for the future too. The big challenge is community is now becoming a curriculum. Teachers are losing control of the curriculum. Maybe that's not a bad thing, I don't know. But teachers are tending to lose control of the curriculum, particularly in higher and further education, because it's what the community wishes to learn now that's much more important than what the teacher wishes them to learn, if that makes sense. So you're seeing a lot of massively online open courses, as I said at the beginning of this presentation, opening up and providing content which is much more relevant to the community, and in fact it's being driven by the community now. The community is actually deciding what they want to learn. And I'll finish with this statement and then provide you with my contact details, and then we'll open up to questions. John Gardner said a very profound thing many years ago. All too often today we are giving young people cut flowers when we should be teaching them to grow their plants. For me, that is the biggest challenge for teachers, is how do we step down, as Paulo Freire says, from becoming the power base and the knowledge base of this, how do we equalize that balance so that the teacher and the student become on the same level and we open up a dialogue between us rather than a direct transmission. Technology, social media, mobile telephony, personal devices, all of these tools are going to give us the power to do that. And we now need to grasp that and make the most of it. So there's my contact details if you want to look at my website or email me or my blog or Twitter me, if you like. Then that's how to get hold of me. So thank you very much for listening, and I hope you've enjoyed that. And perhaps maybe there are some questions now. Okay, I'll take questions on the chat, and then I will respond using the microphone, hopefully. So what's the first question from somebody? We've got no questions at the moment. Like, you know, when is lunch? Or have you had lunch yet? I hope you have. It's always a little disconcerting when no one asks a question. I actually once spoke at an illustration of the power of social media for you to think about. I actually spoke at a conference with just 15 people in it. You know, that was 15 people. And at the end, nobody asked a question. I thought, oh, no, you know, nobody wants to ask a question. So I went to walk out the door, and they said, thank you, Ben. I walked out the door, and someone chased me down the corridor and said, Steve, do you think you would be able to share your slides with us? Because we'd like to think about what you said and then maybe get back to you and ask some questions later on, because it was also new to us, you know, surprisingly. And I said, fine, yeah, and I'll put them onto slideshare.net tonight. So slideshare.net, that there is actually my website where I take the I out, Timbukteeth, like so. And that was my SlideShare site. And I put all my slides up onto there, and then I tweeted it out. And it was amazing because I had 15,000, that's 15,000 views on that SlideShare within the first week. It's now it's over 50,000 now. And this is one way of amplifying your content. It's one way of giving your content away for free, but making a huge audience for it. The reason why there were so many people was firstly because lots of people are connected, and they are on Twitter, and they know SlideShare and know how to use it easily. But the other reason is because some people decided, because of the copyright license being open, they were able to translate it into other languages. Somebody translated it into Spanish, and then the whole of Latin America was able to read it and understand it and respond. So could you elaborate on what should drive the changes for teachers? Yes, the first thing that should drive changes for teachers is the necessity to improve learning. Everything else is secondary to that. Change for change's sake is often a mistake. Change because you want to make things better. That's the important thing. And change has to be thought through. Some change happens because it's been imposed upon you from outside by the government or by an awarding body for an examination or something. But other changes you can make yourselves. And some of those changes can be made just by the person themselves. Others can be made by a department or by a faculty or by the whole school or by the university itself. Any change that takes place should be driven by the desire to improve learning. That's the first and foremost thing, improving the quality of the experience for the student. But there are other things that happen. Some people decide to make changes because they think they can save money. I had managers come to me several years ago and they said, Steve, we need to set up a distance learning program. And I said, why would you want to do that? And they said, well, to save money. And I said, well, that's the last thing that will happen. It will cost more money. If you want to save money, don't go into distance education. If, on the other hand, you want to improve the experience, you want to widen the catchment area for students, you want to enable students to study from home or flexibly, if you want to be able to increase the impact of your learning, then that's a good way of choosing distance education. But if you want to save money, that's not a good choice. So that's what I would suggest to you. It's about quality and about raising standards and improving the learning experience. That, to me, is the biggest driver of change justification. A few years ago, we discussed the bridge between formal and informal learning. Do you think this bridge has been built? Lonnie, I think I remember that conversation. I think it was either on Twitter or the blog or something. There is a blurring of the boundaries between formal and informal learning. As we know, from looking at research from people like Kofer and Cross and various other theorists, about 80% of what we learn is outside of the formal context, on a bus or at home or with friends in the bar or whatever. So a lot of what we learn is outside of that. I think the important thing to think about is that lots of movements, such as the bring your own device movement and massively online open courses and various hangouts that are happening on Google Plus and so on. These are happening informally, but they have an institution behind them. And that's partly, I think, about bridging the gap, or not the gap, but the distinction between formal and informal learning. And I think it's happening slowly but surely. So, yes. Other questions? I think we have about 5 or 10 minutes left. If you want to read up more about my current thinking about education and about technology, then you can go to this site here, which it's on the screen actually. The one at the top is also one of my professional sites, where you can get more information about what's currently happening in the world of learning technology and where I'm speaking and so on. So there's lots of content out there for you to look at. And I would appreciate dialogue with you. If you've got any questions that you want to ask, but are worried about doing here, or cannot for some reason here, then you can tweet me, or you can send me a comment on my blog, or you can email me, and I'll try and respond to you. I am on holiday at the moment, but I do occasionally get into my email account and keep up to date with it. It is often said that students are capable of using internet as a classroom due to Facebook. I am not sure how to transform Facebook knowledge to academic learning. I think I'm getting the answer, the question to that clear in my head. I will say several things here. Firstly, I think it's very difficult for institutions, universities, schools, to use Facebook as a means of reaching students, because it's their domain. And when universities and schools try and encroach upon that, try and move into it, I think children and young people resent that to a certain extent. But if you can get over that problem, then it's a very good tool to use. Probably the best way to use Facebook is to get the students to do it themselves. I've actually tried to set up systems for my students, and they don't use them. But if they actually set up the Facebook account themselves, and then they invite me in as a guest, I don't have ownership of it. I don't have control over it. I don't mind that. They have the control and the ownership, and therefore they make sure that the content is good. They also make sure that they police it so that nothing bad happens on it, and if it does, it gets stamped on by them, not me. And I think students appreciate that, because they gain the control. They gain the autonomy. They gain the agency over what they're doing on Facebook or on any other system for that matter. So I think it's probably better to encourage them to set it up for themselves and manage it themselves. I hope that answers the question. Yeah? I like being able to do this, to sit back in my office and speak and have a cup of tea and have an informal chat with people. And then I'm about 2 seconds away from my living room, which is just through there. So that was the last question, was it, Paul? Thank you, Rennie. Thank you, Paul. Goodbye, everyone. I'll switch off now then. Bye for now.